welcome to episode 10 of the Never On Anything podcast. This has been great to keep you occupied during the virus lockdown. My name is Tony Esmond, writer of the Hall Chronicles, Cotney Kung Fu and Atomic Hercules. Today's guest is my third guest from north of the border. He's both a comics and a comics art collector, and he's also a comics creator. The Lord of the Colony and the Herder of the Penguins, it's Mr. Alan Henderson. Hello, Alan.
Hello. Gonna have to call you up on your numbers there. I think I'm your fourth.
Am I?
Scottish. Who's... Yeah, because you've had Tom, Dave and Johnny.
Oh, I forgot about Johnny. You never forget about Johnny. Oh, dear. You are fourth.
It's because he's a sober Scotsman. That's the thing. You forget.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah, he is. Well, look at that. My mother would be pleased with that. Yeah. So the aim of it is to give an overview of a comic or a series in the hope that people will both find our conversation interesting, brackets, or at least not too annoying, and head off and buy this series or others, and in doing so, keep themselves occupied during these trying times. I asked Mr. H what he would like to talk about, and he jumped at a book that I had not reread for a long time. Did you want to just tell us what the book is, Al?
So the book is Give Me Liberty. And I think we've actually ended up going for the full Life and Times of Martha Washington, which is the, yep. the full package of all of the miniseries and one-shots collected yeah. all together.
No, so, yeah. no short read, my friend. But we both reread it in the last couple of days. I understand, is that right?
Yeah. It's over the last week. I dipped in and out of it. Yeah. You get through the first book really quickly, and then I think it's a bit of a.
It's a funny one, isn't
chip
it?
Chip away at it thereafter.
Yeah, and we'll talk a bit about the length of it soon. Now, interestingly, you just said to me you'd found the solicitation of the... Is this out of an old... I can't remember.
Yes, it was, actually. Yep. We just went on a hunt on a couple of websites that will... I think My Comic Shop, you can actually work... You can search through it to find out what came out in particular months, and it will tell you everything that came out in a given month.
So this will be from 1990 at some point, or...?
So June 1990 yep. for Give Me Liberty number one at a retail price of $4.95, where the solicitation basically reads, the 21st century, in the squalid corridors of a maximum security housing project, she takes on a gangland enforcer. On the war-torn streets of Chicago, she fights the murderous health police. But the real trouble starts when she turns 15.
Well, it ain't wrong, is it?
No, it's not. I must admit, when I reread that this afternoon, I was like, yeah, okay, I can understand why I picked this up way back in 1990.
Yeah. I mean, firstly, I absolutely loved it. So there's going to be very, very few down points, I would suggest, between us around this, because it's a book we both like. There's the odd dip, I'm going to say. So I'll give a little... Yeah. A little rundown of the, because this is a series that stretched over, believe it or not, 17 years.
Yep.
The book we've got, I think, comes in at 521 pages. So you've got like the slipcase version?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's maybe 521 for the
total.
The actual story, but by the time you add all the extras at the back, I think it's 100 or near 600 actually.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and 600 dead. Yeah.
Oh, is it? Yeah, so it's a lump.
But that's all the sketches and stuff. But yeah, it's...
Yeah, you could build a house with these books, couldn't you? You really could.
Definitely.
So in 1990, as you said, we had Give Me Liberty, which is 5 issues. Then over a period of sort of four or five years, we had Happy Birthday, Martha Washington, which is a one-shot. Martha Washington Goes to War, which is 5 issues. And then we had a book called Martha Washington Stranded in Space, which by this time a small imprint had formed, which we'll talk about in a minute, I'm sure. But Dark Horse, where this was published, and that featured Big Guy and Rusty the Robot, which is another sort of similar book of the same, one of the same creators. 1997, we got Martha Washington Saves the World, which was 3 issues. And then the whole 10 years later, in 2007, we got Martha Washington Dies, a one-shot. So no spoilers about what happens at the end of this story, I'm sure. Martha Washington is... a character who was born in 1995 as part of the story, the 11th of March 1995, and she dies the 11th of March 2095, so she lived to exactly 100 years old. She grew up in the Cabrini Green Housing Estate, as you just said, projects in Chicago, and this book was created by Frank Miller on writing, Dave Gibbons on art and lettering. I think he letters the whole thing, do you know?
He certainly does from... And Goes to War was the second mini, but so from there on, certainly.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Because it's when he started doing electronic lettering for the first time.
Right, interesting. Because that's a subject we'll also probably talk about in the colour.
Yeah.
Because the colourists involved in it were Robin Smith and Angus Mackay. And Dave, I saw him, he was on the Kayfabe interviews a couple of months ago. I was watching it. And he was saying that he's always been a bit of a tech head, actually. And he said that he started digital colouring back, I think, in 95, which was really early for him.
Yeah.
And he was using a guy called Angus Mackay to do the colouring, who he said, my computer's far too slow. I don't think I can cope. It will take days to send the material to you or even just sort of put it all together. So David had some money from a image project he'd been involved in during the heyday of Image, you know, when everyone was earning millions and stuff. So he bought Angus a computer to colour on, believe it or not, which is quite interesting. And that's why, I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit, but the colouring does change mid...
It does change quite dramatically, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In moments for good, in moments for bad, I think. So let's do a bit of your history around these creators. So we're of a... I think you're slightly younger than me, but we're of a sort of similar age, Al, aren't we? Where did you see... Miller's work first? Where did you come across his first?
Where did I first come across it? So I got properly back into comics sort of 88, 89
right.
sort of period. So obviously... Post Dark Knight, but Dark Knight was sitting there on the shelf as being the big trade paperback to buy. Yep. So it was probably really that got me into that for him. And you know, that would probably be my first sort of real exposure to him in terms of that side of things. Thereafter, it's obviously being aware of a lot of his earlier Daredevil stuff, but that's I'm more of a DC boy than a Marvel kid.
Yes,
but
that's the thing I've always found interesting about you, is you are more of a DC. I think commonly in England, people are more Marvel, but yeah, you've always been more of a DC guy, haven't you? Yeah,
that was just more... chance than, or you know, what happened those first couple of weeks going back into comic shops and what was there. It wasn't really by design. I think it was also what was the jumping on points at that point. And again, that's why in the sort of very early 90s and very late 80s, anything that was sort of like a new series or was coming out as a new mini series would probably be something that I would pick up.
Yeah,
because I think certainly the X-Men at that point would have been very difficult to jump on.
Yeah, it's been like that since, to be fair.
Well, yeah, you know. And similarly, Spider-Man as a character never appealed to me, so it was always a case of, well, there. And at that point as well, you had, and I know we've done it in previous ones, you've talked about Alan Grant and Ron Breifogel as well.
Yeah.
You had
yeah.
Alan Grant and Ron Breifogel doing a detective run at that point in time where most of the stories were two issues, maybe three. And therefore you were able to get in and out of a story really quick. And I think therefore I was able to say, well, I can understand what's going on. I can build myself up as a reader in this and start growing the arms and legs that come across the universe as you know, from that sort of base.
Yeah. Yeah. I get you. I think for me it was Daredevil. I think I'd seen some, I think he did some covers for Spider-Man around that time, but I don't think I'd bought those ones. And I remember reading one of his first issues on Daredevil, I think, and then thinking, you know, when something's unusual in comics, we kind of like that. We don't immediately warm to him, and it took me a while to warm to him. Historically, his first published thing in comics was he had a letter published in The Cat, the Marvel comic, issue 3. he started hanging out at Neil Adams' studio. Was it the Krusty Bunkers? I can't remember the name of his studio. Is that right? Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. I can't remember the specifics.
And he started hanging out there, and he said Neil Adams would literally tear him a new arsehole every time he took his pages in there. But he kept going back because he knew he was learning something. And he finally took some pages in, and Adams looked at them, didn't say anything to him, picked up the phone, phoned Gold Key, and got him a three-pager in the Twilight Zone, issue 84, June 1978, which is quite a cool little story. he then did some weird war tales and some war stories at DC, and then his first Marvel work was John Carter, Warlord of Mars, issue 18, which I think off the top of my head is the last issue. And then not far off from then, he started bothering, and he was friends with Joe Duffy, who got him as the artist on Daredevil. And he kind of didn't look back from there, really, I suppose. Other than a couple of breaks into movies, which do is one of the reasons this is so fragmented, the Martha Washington stuff, is because he went and did stuff like RoboCop 2 and things like 300 and stuff like that, I think, which is why some of that sort of thing. But he's always been there somewhere. There's always been a little bit of something going on with him. I suppose after Daredevil, the next thing I saw was the Lone Wolf and Cub covers, which I really... Oh, maybe Year One. Maybe Year One.
Year One was probably the... Was good. I was going to say that's the other thing that I've...
Yeah.
It's, that jumps out in terms of that space, which, again, is that DC approach at the time of here's a mini-series, but inside the main series.
Yeah, yeah.
Which helped me in terms of reading it.
Yeah, that's like a... It's a in these days, it would be given its own graphic novel or something, wouldn't it? It's that sort of story, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And what about Gibbons? So where did you start seeing his stuff?
So I would have seen Gibbons' work in British publications, but not known that it was him.
Exactly. Yeah.
There'd be quite a lot of that. In terms of recognizing him as a character name, again, it's probably going to be Watchmen in terms of so that's who he is.
Yeah.
Thereafter, it would be some of the Green Lantern work around the edges of that.
Yeah.
And then probably into this and various other things beyond. Yeah. I also remember meeting him at one of the very first cons that I was at, which again was a lot later. It was about it would be after all most of this had come out.
Yeah.
It'd be about 2000 down in Bristol.
Oh, you went to Bristol. I was at many of the Bristols, my friend. Yeah.
This would be one of the ones that was in the hotels rather than in the before we moved to the watershed.
Right. Okay.
But anyway, it was meeting him at that and. I think the fun one is actually seeing Leah Moore come up to him and call him Uncle Dave, which always tickled me.
Yeah, that's right.
That was that sort of relationship they had. And then across that weekend, we ended up in the lift together in the hotel room, in the hotel, I should say, going up to our bedrooms. And then I was like, that's weird. That's Dave Gibbons is in the lift here. And just like, okay. But yeah, so that's probably my history with them.
Yeah.
The thing that amazed me when I look at some of their credits here is the fact that, because if you look at them both now, you would not think that Dave Gibbons was the one that was older by 8 years.
Yeah, I know. If you look at them now, Dave's considerably spryter, isn't he, these days?
Yeah.
I think there was a certain worry, wasn't there, amongst fans and industry people when he sort of reappeared wearing his hat and looking very gaunt.
Frank Miller,
Miller, yeah. Mm. Yeah, everyone was very worried about him, weren't they, sadly? Yeah. Where did you? So my copy of sort of a long story short is my copy of the Dave Gibbons stuff is from him actually. Weirdly, I used to go to a comic shop in St Albans, which was owned by a guy called Derek, who sadly has passed away now. But it used to be the local shop to Dave. In fact, I think it still is. I don't go to that one now. I said, well, we don't go to anyone at the moment, do we? But I don't think he mind me saying, but Dave gets two of everything that DC put out.
Yeah.
It's kind of his deal. And so you name it, he gets two, I don't know, Nightwing statues. He gets to, and he would swap some of these in to the shop to get for sort of store credit and get comics that, Marvel comics are all back issues because he's a big back issue fan. And like yourself, the higher coin collectors, of which I was one, and I'm sure you are as well, Al, would every Christmas get a present from Derek, the bloke who run it.
Right.
And I got the slipcase, and I opened it up, and he'd done it already. I'd sent it to you, didn't I? Because we both have similar sketches. It had a really lovely sketch inside it, and that's how I got that. Is yours? You sent me a sketch as well. Is that from inside that slipcover, or is that separate?
No. Right. That sketch was from a Birmingham convention.
Right.
The very first Bix, way back, whenever that would be.
So many places, man. I was there too. Yeah, okay.
The number of times we've crossed paths without actually knowing before we did cross paths. That would just be one of those wandering around and there's Dave Gibbons sitting, because it should always be a crime in some ways that you would go to some of these cons and Dave Gibbons would be sitting there but nobody in front of him.
Yeah.
It's partially because he knows how to deal with a crowd, because he can do his Rorschach sketch in under 30 seconds, if not less.
Yeah.
So therefore he gets through people really quickly. And it was just a case of, well, I've got the Rorschach sketch from it. I'll ask for a Martha Washington sketch. So that's just in one of the little sketchbooks at the side. So I would have just picked up the slipcase Actually, it can't have been Amazon because it's 2009. That's probably before I was really doing big Amazon orders. So it probably would have been Forbidden Planet, Edinburgh.
Okay.
At that point.
I have to say, Dave is an absolute gent. I never fail to be impressed with either how smart he is or how kind he is. I used to take my son into Chaos City when he was much younger, when he was sort of 12, 13, and he was a huge Green Lantern fan. And he was chatting to Dave. You know, Dave was just being kind and chatting to this kid about Green Lantern. And he was telling Dave about all his favourite characters and storylines and stuff. And next time we went in, Dave had left a sketch of Green, or a fully inked picture of Green Lantern for him.
Oh, lovely.
Like, what a nice guy. Yeah, incredibly nice. Yeah. So a little background on Dave. So Dave Chester Gibbons, I never knew that was his name. If I see him, I should be reminded of that one. A fan of American comic books from an early age, born in 1949 in Forest Gate in North London. North East London. His earliest printed work was in UK underground comics. But he also worked for... he did Year of the Shark Men for Wizard. Have you ever seen that?
I'm going to say no.
Right. You might have done, because it's sort of a sort of submarine and the men have got sort of shark teeth. They're like men with shark teeth.
Right.
If you go to Lou Stringer's blog called Blimey and look it up, there's some scans of the pages. And they're pretty good. You know, they really are pretty good stuff.
Oh, he's always, I think we'll come on to this. He's always had a tight line.
Yeah, he really has. Yeah, he really has. And then we got some 2000 AD, we've got Harlem Heroes, which I just genuinely think is like this book should be talked about more. You know, people talk about diversity in comics. You know, I was a 10-year-old kid reading Harlem Heroes, and, you know, these guys were my heroes, you know. But, you know, I didn't know any black Americans who, you know, kind of were essentially meant to play basketball but played this sort of future sport, you know, and you didn't think twice about it. I actually enjoyed his Dandare a lot. I don't know if you've gone back and reread that, have you? Or...
Oh, not for... Now, there's another thing that is at least a decade past since I looked at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember it fondly from that point. Yeah,
really nice stuff. And then, obviously, one of my big favourites is the Terramex, the Robuster story. The sort of working class robot who takes on the corporate giant robot. So this is just a beautiful thing. And then scan over a couple of other classics. So you've got the Iron Legion in Doctor Who. Which they've just done, Big Finish have just done an audio play of, which is superb, like really good. You got the Big E, so he...
That's possibly the first time I've ever heard you be positive about Doctor Who.
You may be right. Yeah. Don't get me started. So Tornado was not a competition, but it was also a weekly sci-fi kind of story that eventually got hatched, matched and dispatched into 2000 AD. And he is, if you can find the early issues, he was the Big E. So he was like the Tharg character, and he used to dress up and stand on the rooftops of buildings and stuff like that. The Big E, a.k.a. Percy Pilbeam, was his Joe Public name. And then I think, like you, I thought, oh, right, Dave Gibbons is in American comics. Just suddenly I picked up a comic and read Green Lantern and thought, oh, this is Dave Gibbons. Well, wow, you know. And he was working with like Len Wein. In fact, I heard him give a lovely little story about Len Wein on Werblin the other day, talking about what a good guy he was. You always hear good stories about Len, but I think they have a particularly good working relationship. And then he does do some writing as well, as opposed to just art or art and drawing. So he did World's Finest with Steve Rude, which I thought was particularly good.
Yeah, again, a great little miniseries that... Yeah. I'd forgotten that he'd written that.
Yeah, and to get Steve to draw it, he got him over to St Albans, and he stayed at his house because he was.
Right.
Yeah, he told me once. He said he was so late. He came over, and they went to the park and were drawing things. And he said Steve was a little strange but good company. I think is the phrase he used. So that's a little bit about Dave. So I thought we could have a little bit of a chat about what we thought about it, and we. Bear in mind, it's whatever it is, 521 pages. We're probably not going to go over it all. But
no.
So you bought it off the rack straight away, did you? When you saw it, first issue. Is that what you're saying?
I would have done way back, and because I was trying to remember as well at that point. I mean, this came out in prestige format, the first mini series,
right?
If I remember correctly,
wasn't spined, was it? As I understand it, it wasn't. It was just hard.
I'd have to go.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But it was more square bound.
Yeah, it was much more sturdy.
And you know, at that point, there was this is another thing in terms of the scene setting for the early 90s or late. You know, comics were, you properly had them in different categories at that point. You had your monthly comics, and then if something was a really good story, they put it into the annual. So you got a nice thick annual and a story. And then if it was a really special story, they put it into prestige format.
Yeah.
And if it was something that was an amazing thing, then they put it into hardback.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, so you knew that hardback coming out was an event. So the fact that there hadn't been many miniseries coming out that came out in prestige format.
Yeah.
Prior to this, you know, obviously you got Dark Knight that did. And
I remember buying them because they were so rare. I remember stuff like...
We had the Cult as well. And then this would have been...
Yeah.
You know, I think it was the first time that I remember a Dark Horse piece coming out in that. So it stood out from that. They had a brilliant set of covers in terms of just the style for drawing you in.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of white space.
Yeah.
And, you know, very bold Americana type image in it, and you know, very clear bold lettering.
Yeah.
And you're looking at it going, look, this is one half of Dark Knight and one half of Watchmen. What could possibly,
I know. It was almost like
let's jump on board.
I remember thinking at the time, I can't believe they're working together. It was almost that much, because they were both like the big superstars. Dark Knight and Watchmen have always been the two books that have vied for being the best comic of all time, really, you know, by most sort of general, you know, Joe Public readers. And I was thinking, oh, they can't be working together. What's that all about? Yeah. I'm going to say it didn't for me, but did you ever think, oh, black female? It didn't.
Never crossed my mind at all in terms of
that. It's only later
in terms of that.
Probably, do you know what? Until you said to me on Twitter the other day, you said, look, it's not talked about. This is an important book. And I thought, yeah, well, fucking hell, it is. It just never occurred to me that it is a book about a single, like, very headstrong, very clever black female who comes from a very poor background. But it was just a good story to me. And I absolutely loved the character. For all the different sort of personality quirks she has through it, she's a brilliantly formed character. I mean, what's your thoughts on her? Do you remember back then what you thought?
Well, I think it's interesting as well, in that while, yes, she is the main character, for Give Me Liberty, for the first book, for the first story arc, she's the protagonist that takes you through, but there's so much more that hangs off it that actually creates the whole world around it.
Yeah.
Some of which is very difficult to read without putting a Trumpian view over it. I don't know if you felt that when reading some of the politics and satire.
Yeah.
Where, you know, so because the first book is a very strong satire. It's a very strong, you know, look at the inequalities of class.
Yes.
It's got a very strong view with regard to the makeup of America in terms of its constituents and different
in all areas, in
religious
and
groupings
race and religion and. Even Texas is treated differently, isn't it? That's almost like a villain.
Yeah.
The boroughs of New York are warring with each other, and there's all this sort of thing going
on. You know, the treatment of Native Americans and all that. So the fact that the protagonist that takes you through the story happens to be a black female is, she's female as well, and B, she happens to be black. You're like, well, whatever. It's it's just the storyline that fades through. I think she becomes much more prominent as being a black female throughout the rest of the books thereafter, where it's much more focused on her. But I think for book one, you don't notice it because you're so engrossed in the whole world that's being presented.
I think in retrospect, maybe I felt she was more vulnerable because she was a female in a world of, like, you know, great big robots and fighting machines and, you know, all this sort of thing. I think in retrospect, I maybe thought at the time, because I'm always worried for her. I'm watching it. I'm always concerned whether she'll survive, because everybody dies around her, don't they? Everyone, really, pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing as well is that I talked about being in the synopsis of the solicitation about, and then she turns 15.
Yeah.
You forget that even by the end of the first storyline, she's still only 16, 17. And in fact, even, you know, I think by the end of, well, before she comes back to die, I think she's only 23 by the end of that.
That struck me as well, because I think someone says she's 23, she could have been, and she's so good, she could have been a captain by now, but she upsets everyone. I think that's a phrase, and I went, oh, fuck me, she's still young. Of course she is, she's still very young.
She's really young. Yeah. And I don't know, it's maybe one of the things that, you know, obviously she's had a heavy paper round, so therefore it's you know, she's not drawn as being a particularly young looking character.
Yeah.
imagine if it was done nowadays, there would be a much more manga-esque type look to her, yes, to make her look even younger. But you know, so there's all that vulnerability throughout that she carries.
I think,
in terms of why this book's not talked about,
that
must be part of it.
I think also, I think one of the issues with it, and it's seen as of an age, I think because you can say there's a touch of Total Recall about it, there's a touch of RoboCop, there's a touch of Starship Troopers about it somewhere along the line.
I've written down a list of references, but then you start going, what came before what?
Yeah.
Because there are certainly tropes in here where it has a Dark Knight feel, you know, where they use the television presenter to talk about things. You've got the mutants in there. There are certain Watchmen pieces as well. Yeah.
There's a character who appears who may as well be Manhattan, isn't there? There's
towards the end. That's
In other words, he had his knob out. That's basically
And there's a big blue person as well. But no, there's a couple of... I'm trying to find the panel. So, if you turn to page 36, the bottom panel on page 36, where it's the couple huddled against the wall with the shadow against the wall behind them, that to me screams Watchmen as well. If there had been... if he'd written Who Watches the Watchmen in graffiti on that wall, it would not look out of place.
I agree completely.
So there's that color. I also think the character, one of the characters we've not talked about yet, Raggy Ann, that has very much an Akira feel to me.
Very much so. And he'd heavily been influenced in Ronin and stuff like that with co-joining of Japanese art and manga and American comics, hadn't he? And this is, you can definitely see the reflection in that. But I was thinking also you've got Pax. The Pax characters look like something from 2000 AD. There's a...
Yes, and all the spaceships when he gets back into that, you can very much tell that's him back in his wheelhouse of doing all the things for that piece.
Yeah.
The only references I was going to say as well when you get later on it, Mars Attacks is in there.
Okay. It is, isn't it?
I think
it really is in that.
Which is weird because
the one off one is it stranded or stranded space, whichever the one is.
So there's a Mars Attacks thing in there, and I think there's 2001, I should say, A Space Odyssey. Yeah. In terms of some of the piece. But there's lots of stuff that I think where they cross-reference that and they play on the tropes of those pieces. But that's maybe one of the reasons why it's pulling everything else together rather than it's one.
I was surprised. I remember reading it as it came out and feeling a tiny bit that it was going around in circles, a little bit, because people would go and then appear and she'd get killed and then she'd survive, and you know, it was, I felt a little bit like that, and I actually felt the read of the whole thing a much more satisfying read. I think if I'd have read this in trades, it probably would have
The other thing in terms of the original series, again, because I was doing some research on it this afternoon, it came out quarterly, not monthly.
Yes, I remember that.
So it took a whole, so the first four issue arc took a year to get through, and my attention span.
Yeah, I know. I can never remember what happened in last month with the X-Men. Never mind.
I think that's partly. I think you're right. It reads. I also think there's quite a lot of callbacks as well in terms of certain images that are maybe not identical to the same way that they were in the Watchmen approach. But there's a lot of the image quite early on where she's killed the gangster and is hiding inside the locker. And she's got the eyes that just stare out. If you actually go through the book, there are a number of times whenever she's sort of shocked or is in that zone of going, I can't believe what I'm seeing in front of me. He uses the same sort of facial expression or just her getting slightly older for it. And there's that sort of, maybe I'm overreaching in terms of what I'm seeing there, with that sort of Watchmen expectation. But I think there's that again you would never pick up unless you read it as a whole.
And I think the Watchmen thing is relevant to mention. I was looking up a quote of Dave, which is in this book actually. It's in one of the he does like pages before stories start, and he was talking about the comparison between Alan Moore and Frank Miller, and he said Alan is a classical composer, a Mozart. Everything is a vast symphony all mapped out, and he says Frank is a jazz virtuoso like Miles Davis. Impeccable technical skills, but ready to jump off on flights of fancy at any moment. And I think I kind of like that. You know, Dave encapsulates, Dave like captures phrases like that so often when I hear him talk. And yeah, he's right about that. But I kind of like the fact it goes off on one. I don't always like the plan so much with Frank's work. I read Hard Boiled and talked about it a few weeks ago, and I feel that about that as well. It's he allows just to go off, and you know, it does a little bit at the moment.
I flicked through Hard Boiled this afternoon, okay, rather than to read it. It is like a total Where's Wally book at times. Partially because as well, I know somewhere in Hard Boiled, and I didn't spend long enough looking, there is the pack symbol in the background in one of the panels.
I spotted it the other day, yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's going to take me forever to find this because there's so much detail in some of these pages. And I suppose we should, for the listener, we should say that there is a crossover to Hard Boiled in one of the stories as well that is in the middle of the book that was taken out of Dark Horse Presents, where Nixon, the Hard Boiled character, turns up.
Now, a lot of this, another thing we talked about, and we can mention that as well, is Dark Horse Presents was an event anthology back then, wasn't it? You know, I remember buying the one with, is it issue 50? I can't remember the one with Marv strapped to the electric chair on the front and stuff like that. Though at the time, they were quite hot books, you know.
There's loads of stuff that came out of Dark Horse Presents another criminally underrated book is Concrete.
Yeah, I love
it. To the start.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I read a book called, I don't know if you remember it, there was a book called Rust, which came out from, I think, AC Comics, of similar. And I remember picking up Concrete because I thought it was Rust. I thought, oh, Rust's back out again. That's a bit weird. Rust was always a bit sort of lascivious. And I think, oh, no, this is better. This is amazing. And that first book of Concrete where he's swimming. I love that book. It's not. That's another one that's not mentioned enough, you know.
Yeah. But Dark Horse Presents also was the first thing that brought you, was the first ever crossover between Aliens and Predator.
Right.
Which, culturally is you know, a big thing now.
Because before the movies ever happened.
You're right, Sin City appeared there first. And it had so many other little things in it. I think it was another... It ran too long.
As
the thing with all anthologies, it loses control at times, and it needed to, or it always needs good editorship, I suppose. And it probably was cost, or it cost the image resurgence meant that people that perhaps would have gone, oh, I've got a short story to tell, I can tell it in DPH, they took it over to Image
to put it out there. Jumping out of plane. I get you. worth mentioning here is Legend as well, which I know we talked about the other day. So Legend was an imprint that came out of Dark Horse between 94 and 98. Did you know it was also almost called Dinosaur?
Again, having read this book just now, it was like, what? Yeah. Where did that come from?
They even had T-shirts that's got sent out with this dinosaur imprint on. It was kind of created to, I'm not going to say corral, but point the interest of some bigger creators into doing their own story. So you had Art Adams, who did Monkey Man and O'Brien, which is a great book. You had Miller doing this, and Big Guy and Rusty the Robot and Sin City. You had Byrne, and I mean, Byrne was doing 2112. He did Next Men with them.
Next Men was great. I loved Next Men at the
really
time.
Do.
Again,
yeah.
Because that was my, I can't get into X-Men. It's too complicated to get all the history. Oh, here's from the start. Fine, I'll just start here.
Yeah. I know it was for sale. I've got it as one of those sort of backup ones if I'm ever bored on a train on my iPad to reread. I think it was cheap on Comixology. But you had Danger Unlimited out of Byrne and Babe as well. You had, like you said, Concrete. You had Madman from Michael Ridd. You had and Walt Simonson. I can't remember the name of the book Walt Simonson did, but if you look through this collection, some of them did variant covers, or the early days of variant covers, maybe pinups. In the back of one of the issues, didn't they? I think Mignola.
Yeah, the Mignola one's
great. Yeah, it's great. I'm not so warm on the Paul Chadwick one. I think he rushed that one off a little bit. If you get a chance to see that one, but yeah.
Yes. Are you that one? I must admit, I looked at that and I went, if you put that image in front of me and said, "What book is this from?" I'd be like, "Not a clue."
No, would we?
Not a clue.
Yeah, exactly. Should we talk a little bit about the first few issues, and then I want to have a conversation with you about tone and what you think about where it's going. So, like we said, the first issue is bleak AF. I think as the kids say. And she's basically, I mean, it's not sexual, but it's physical child abuse, essentially. She's treated so badly, you know.
Well, there's, I think there's overtones of, well, she isn't subject to the sexual abuse, but there is the whole suggestion where she gets kidnapped off the street and taken to one of the gangsters, who then himself gets, well, the door's closed, so you don't quite know what happens to him. But, he, you know, he's dismissed because, you know, he's pointing out, she's a little girl. I didn't want a girl. I wanted a boy.
Right. Yeah.
And you're like going, well, yeah, okay, hang on. So I'm like 6 or 7 pages in and we're discussing child rape here. This is what, where are we going with this book?
Immediately. It's isn't it? Immediately. Yeah. There's a bit, one of the pages that really sung out for me early on was she's escaped the home and did it get blown up? I can't remember now. Early on. And she's lying on the floor in just a deserted, where a building's been knocked down, and she's lying on the floor sleeping and saying, I just want to die. And it's the most heartbreaking scene. Incredible. You know. And then you begin to realise that she is a survivor. And that's the theme, I think, for her a lot of the way through it, is she survives. No matter what gets thrown at her, she survives to the right old age of 100. And she kills one of the those medic soldier characters. And the blood is everywhere. You know, there's so much blood everywhere.
Yeah.
And she says that there's an organisation called PAX, which is the, what's it called in America? Is it the Peace Corps?
It's
kind of the Peace Corps, but they also carry shotguns and machine guns and kill people and stuff. And that, there's a big thing that says if you join PAX, your whole criminal history will be wiped. You get a new start. You get a job. And she decides, look, she says, she's like a lot of guys joining the army in every country around the world these days, especially in the poorer places in England and Scotland. They join the army because they don't have a choice. And she joins the army, and after a short amount of training, she's basically parachuting into a massacre. Yeah, like straight into it. Yeah. Just that first issue just goes everywhere. You know, it's so complicated, but, well, not complicated, it's so much story in one issue, you know.
That and establishing a number of the background pieces of the president, they've repealed the 22nd Amendment, which means that he can basically continue to be elected as president. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's the scene quite early on as well where she's doing the quiz in the school, and basically she's trying to say that the answer to every question is President Rexall. Though she gets down to the point about who freed the slaves, who was President Rex.
That's right. She remains a little bit uneducated, doesn't she, as the book goes on? Even in the later stories, somebody says euphemism to her, and she says, I don't know what that word is.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting.
Well, again, that's that whole point. You forget that she will have left school circa, I don't know when she had getting thrown out the housing estate. You know, she would have been about 12, 13.
Yeah.
Because she must have spent a couple of years in the asylum.
Yeah.
There's nothing that you go, oh, and here's where the happy bit happens.
I know.
So when she got kicked out of the house and then moved to the asylum before she had to get kicked out of the asylum and kill the guy to so there's a lot in that. But they also introduce in the first book a really interesting technique to break the stories up with the magazine covers.
Yes.
And there's two here. One we'll talk about in a second, but I'll do the second one first. The ERA. So basically, look, the cover's done to look like it's a Time magazine, and it's got one of the president pictures on it of him, and then it's got the whole sort of interaction with him with the Apache Nation and the background of that. Now, it's a really good way of sort of like establishing again that establishment position, because it's like saying, look, this is a proper this is a proper news magazine, so we're going to talk to you about this. I actually do wonder if Dave Gibbons himself leant on the old Look and Learn books, because there's one of these where I'm like going,
I wondered where that had spiked for me. Yeah, no, I agree completely. I know exactly where you're coming from that.
You know, because it's the sort of, oh, here's what a campfire looks like, it's in the woods, and it's that. But I think it's a really interesting technique for saying, look, we're giving some authority to this piece, but we're making it look like it's media, so you should listen to it and agree with it. Because the first of the magazine covers that comes up is Meat Rack.
I posted that on my Twitter saying there's some good articles in Meat Rack.
So
And the sexualisation of the tax officer, essentially, is what you got there. You know, they're going, they're, you know.
Yeah, which again is very, you know, it's very sort of Vietnam type view of this is the magazine that the soldier would have had. But I just wondered if that's the sort of magazine that would have had any sort of advertising in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
That's the biggest segue I can
okay.
give you.
So yeah. Interesting you should say that, Alan, because we do have a moment from one of our sponsors. Been with your partner too long? Look over at him or her. Look over at him or her now. What a slob. Crisps down his, stroke her, pyjama top, and it's only noon. Listen, you could be wanking off a businessman in a top-class hotel suite or beating a vicar with his studded belt. Why not become a prosy? Okay, thank you, Alan. Sorry about that, mate. Line from there.
That's all right. That's in, and that might have been the sort of advertising they had in Meat Rack.
Yeah, it could well have been. Yeah.
we should have pre-organized that one more.
Yeah. I thought you had some big revelation. I got so caught up in your conversation. No. I'm thinking, oh, what is he coming up with now? It's going to be so good. Yeah, that's good.
I was right about the look and learn piece, but no, it was just the fact I saw that. I thought, oh, yeah, you'll want to talk about it. Do the adverts out.
First issue, though, going back to the battle, suddenly you're dropped into the most awful battle.
Yeah.
And not only is it awful, but at the end they get this sort of horrific mustard gas thing going on. You know, it harks back to the First World War. And everyone dies. And she says, this won't kill me. I won't die here. And again, she proves she's a survivor. And it's like a constant, I thought, I absolutely love this character. What a great character. You know? It's single-minded.
And it's the beautiful scene towards the end as well, where she just walks off into it's actually not even the end. She walks off into the woods, and because the battle's set down in the Amazon, to see the rainforest, and then it's the whole thing about the treachery coming around,
so
and her commanding officer.
This is when we get Moretti, who's the villain for a big chunk of the years of this series, isn't he? He's kind of the thorn at her side, and she beats him, but he survives and he doesn't take it well. And he comes back and he is her boss for a lot of it. And he treats her badly, and he's part of the Julius Caesar Ides of March attack on the president, isn't he? And he leads that. And a real sort of nasty... I don't know if you think this, but he also looks like Dan Dare to me. There's a Dan Dare quality to his face. But he's this sort of... He's the opposite to her. So he's this rich kid who's become an officer. And she's this, you know.
Well, I don't know. Again, it's with reading it with a more modern view. But you know, when you read it the first time, I was like, oh, he is her Captain Dan from the Forrest Gump type thing, where it's, he's the one that has the background. And you're right. He's not the nice character at all. And again, it's then that she's like the new authoritarian figure. And, you know, the end of the book there, of the first issue, the last line being, I don't give him any shit, which is a hark back to the whole thing about when she was getting kidnapped as a child, knowing that she was basically going to be taken into, or potentially taken into, sex trade as well. She said the easiest things to give no shit. And again, you're just like, this is just so harsh.
Yeah, you're right. It's the thing with it as well is she is, at just a moment's notice, her life is done. She's cheap. She's nothing. She's counsellor state trash to some of these people. And you know she rushes into situations constantly. There's one in one of the final books where she just like motorbikes into into death. But she keeps coming back. Yeah. That's the interesting part of it. There's one of the other things that I spotted as well in the early pages is you get a lot of conversation. It's not a heavily written book, but there's more than you would perhaps find in some similar sort of science fiction books these days. There's a lot of conversations, but then Dave like blows the page up by I always think of is the one of the image of Fat Boy, and they're attacking this sort of Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man kind of character, who is actually their equivalent of McDonald's. He's kind of the icon, the character from the fast food chain, is this sort of gingerhead kid, but coming out of his mouth is a machine gun, and it's like a tank coming at them, and suddenly you get this big page splash of them fighting this thing called Fat Boy, and
I mean it's the Iron Giant dressed as Ronald McDonald,
it is,
essentially,
it is. Yeah, it really is.
Well, you know, and given that in one hand, you know, yes, he's got the gun sticking out of his mouth that they're all firing him, but in one hand he's got the big Coke, and the other hand he actually has the big burger, which is just surreal in terms of, you know, it's set up. But yeah, full page splash of a giant robot attacking them in the, you know, and it's bigger than most of the tree or than the, you know, the Amazon trees and stuff out there. So it's giving that perspective of being absolutely huge.
And that's something they do a lot, is they mix politics and big business. They, and you know, the lead the lead of the politicians isn't, you know, the powerful in the country or not. You know, I mean, the Surgeon General is more powerful than the president at one point. It's a strange brew. It's a stew of weirdness and far right corporations and stuff like that, isn't it? Almost a lot of the way through it. And he plays politics a lot. I know Frank was asked whether he was a conservative, I think, a few years ago, and he said, no, I'm a libertarian. And I don't know what he is, and I you know, his politics should not influence this, but this does, to me, show the pervasive, pernicious nature of the right and the way that they are beginning to control the poor. You know, there's that to it. You know, it's not a communist comic. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of not a socialist agenda. It's commercialism, no, capitalism, you know.
It's very anti-authoritarian. Yeah. That is the thing, because and where you believe that authority comes from, whether it's actual government or big business, the way that they, and that's where it's interesting. I think when the Civil War in America breaks out, and all the different factions basically coalesce around each of the different, as you say, Texas goes, well, we're just going to be our powerhouse.
Do you know what? Then I love got, because I'm a big fan of Scout, and that's what happens in Scout War Shaman. You know, like suddenly. Which moments of this reminded me of it, actually, with the Apache characters.
I must admit, as I was reading that, I thought you would go over that at some point, because it makes sense for that in terms of the way it ties together. But and then the breakup thing, we'll go to the Surgeon General one place where he's, you know, disease is a crime.
Disease is a crime. I think the design.
As a character, his design.
Oh, brilliant.
It maybe starts to move better, you know, show a bit more in one of the later series, but it's just, you know, it's scary. Yeah. You know, he's full surgical gowns, full surgical mask.
He speaks what, in an eye strange, piece. Staccato, repetitive. He's a great character. And I have to say, the sequence where there's loads of them and they're sort of flowing down the stairs and back up the hill and stuff later on in this, as in the same gown, and they're all repeating the same phrases, is hauntingly. I mean, that would make that's such an amazing scene from a layout point of view and everything. Another group I wanted to run by you, which I know that you knew as soon as you saw them, you thought I would bring them up, are the militant gay racist group called the Aryan Thrust.
Well, one of the other references I'd written down as a potential thing was actually Blazing Saddles.
Right, okay.
Because the scene at the end where they break in, and it is the, I suppose it's the takeoff of the producers, but isn't it? Where it's the gay Nazis dancing around. Yeah. But we'll give them their own space on the map in terms of they're going to take over some of the land and stuff.
For those that haven't seen it, the Aryan Thrust are. I don't know what the name of it is. What's that? Is it Thing from Finland? I always forget. Is it Tom from Finland? Is that the character? You know, these sort of in leather biker gear. It's gay iconography. And they kind of look like him, but they're a terrorist paramilitary organisation who are seemingly quite players. You know, they seemingly are pretty rough, you know. And they appear at one point, and you just know that you just know that Dave and Frank are just laughing at this. Can we throw in this to make it more crazy? It's almost like they were in a competition with Ron Smith's Mega City One. You know, it's like, this leads me on. So I wanted to have a chat with you about the tone, your thought. We'll go back to the story in a minute, but the tone tone of it. I just wondered what you thought about. And it leads a little bit on from what we're saying about why is it not still talked about. And I think one of the reasons I think that it's not is it's too complicated for people to make their mind up about it sometimes. And I think it's got something of a complicated, if not mixed up, tone. What do you think?
It's also what genre is it?
Yeah.
because you've got, you know, there's even before they do the, well, there are space elements in the first book because there's the big space laser cannons. But
oh,
yeah, so is it a sci-fi thing?
It goes full on 2001.
And well, towards the end, it went in some of the later books. You know, so is it? But is it a sci-fi book, or is it a political satire book, or is it a ecological thing? Because there's the whole thing when she and the Indian are first, the American. Was sustained, or you know, when the American data over there, she's the, you know, he's the eagle, and he's trying to work out what she is, and he goes, well, of course, you're a jaguar, you know, and there's, so you've got images of when David says, I'm just going to paint a nice cat, and just there we go, so I think it's very difficult to, and you shouldn't be putting things into silos anyway or to badges, but them, it's very difficult to say, oh, you know, you like this type of book, therefore you'll like this one. Because
modern sensibility, I'm right. I enjoy books that don't have, you know, boundaries. But I think people now, it might confuse them somewhere. Exactly. Yeah.
I know that because you'd asked this of one of your previous guests about saying, who would you recommend the book to? And I must admit, I was reading this, so I've got no idea.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, it's not always, oh, because you like Star Wars, you'll like this. No, because you like...
I was thinking the same about, I was comparing it to The Road Warrior, because there are moments of The Road Warrior in this, you know. Especially when she meets the mutants, and they're on motorbikes, and she tries to kill one of them, and he likes the fact she's kicked him in the balls, so he makes her his friend.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, that's like Road Warrior, even with the Apache clan. There's moments that are like flipping pantomime. There's a sex comedy element to it. I mean, you've got to remember that the nurses in this are all giant blondes who look like, it was Sylvester Stallone's wife who's in Red Sonja, whatever her name was.
Oh.
They look, do you know, they're all seemingly based on her. Every nurse that turns up is about 7 foot tall.
But with the mark on their face so they can be assessed as to who which one they are.
Yeah.
And this one, you talk about the surreal piece. You know, I flicked a page over here, where it's the president's brain in the jar. And you're like, what? Yeah. Which led to the line that I posted this morning when the Surgeon General kidnaps the president's jar. And it's the soldier standing over one of the medics who's been killed going, the president's brain is missing.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very fitting for
hippy-dippy, 1969 spy comedy of some kind, you know, Our Man Flint or something. It's almost like out of that, you know.
Yeah.
And there's moments of humour in it. There are moments like the 94th Amendment of the United States forbids breeding, slaughter, or sale of red meat. Yeah, you're like, what the fuck is that all about? Where did that just come from? I don't know, you know. And there's mecha battles in it. There's the State of Art, one of the short stories, which is one of my favourites, has like a mecha battle in it, you know. Tonally, I think it's all over the map, but then it's allowed to be. It's that there's that depth to it that it's allowed to be fair.
Well, and this is where one of the ones where I was like going, oh, why wouldn't this be a television series?
Yeah.
You know, partially because it'd be very difficult to cast a young girl into the part. But if it was a television series, this is the sort of thing that I would imagine happening with a telly, because where, you know, the writers go, right, that was that episode out of the way. We now need another one. What the hell are we going to put in it? And it's like, tell you what, put the president's brain in a jar. All right, so what we do next week? Send her into space.
Yeah, it'll be like, season 3 will be in space.
What we do in the week
it's like that, isn't it? Yeah, yeah, it really is.
And there is a bit of me, and I suppose it's back to that whole the jazz reference from earlier on, where I think Miller writing it was kind of just going, I've had another idea, just chuck it in and see where we go with it. Because it just kind of grows like that in terms of just being one thing after another. Yeah. But I refuse to believe when he started writing Give Me Liberty that he knew anywhere near the ending
would be. Oh, me too. Yeah, I remember reading the ending. Did you read the last issue that came out in 2007 as it came out, or did you read it later?
Yes, you know, I would. This is where I could turn around and say that I've reread Give Me Liberty a few times, but most of the other miniseries, this was the first time rereading them.
Yeah, me too.
Since
that's exactly my experience.
They probably first came out.
I remember reading the last, is it The Death of Martha Washington? Yeah, The Death of Martha Washington. I remember reading that and actually thinking it's a very simply told story, but a beautifully told one. And it came kind of out of nowhere. I remember walking in the comic shop and I hadn't seen it in previews or anything. And I went, oh, there's a new Martha Washington book out, and buying it and thinking, oh, she died. But it's well told.
Well, it's brilliant. I mean, in terms of the book as a whole, in terms of the Life of Times of Marshall Bonton book as a whole, I think Give Me Liberty is probably the strongest piece of it in terms of partially because, and let's talk about colouring and backgrounds in a second. It's the strongest of the storylines, I think, and it sets everything up. It's very hard. Even the end of it is very harsh, where, look, we're talking about a book that's 30 years old. If I'm giving you spoilers, I'm sorry. But in the end, she gets herself, in a room with Morelli, and actually, having found him guilty, basically gives him a belt, says, there you go, you can hang yourself. Yeah. And he does.
And he says, don't leave the room, I don't want to do it on my own. Which is quite a moment, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah. Oh, and it's even worse than that. It's because it's the whole thing about the fact he kicks the chair and the belt doesn't break his neck. He chokes and gurgles and twitches. His eyes bulge and his tongue pokes out. It takes several minutes for him to stop. Yeah. I listen. I'll soon call the guards. She just lets him suffer. Yeah. And you're like, how harsh is this?
He's horrific, but... She's no superhero, she's... Yeah.
No, not by that point, no. So I think that... The thing is, if Martha Washington Dies had come out straight after that, I actually think it's really fitting. Yeah. Because reading Martha Washington Dies again, which starts off about... it's talking about her being an explorer.
Right. Yeah.
Because there's a big gap between Saves the World... And dies.
There's a huge gap, yeah. It's 10 years, isn't it?
I'm meaning in story terms. In publication terms, it was 10 years. In story terms, it's like 70 years. And so clearly there's, but the fact that she's back on Earth at that point and everything makes much more sense. Yeah. And I think as an overall piece, I would actually have probably kept her more Earthbound. Yeah, there's a lot she'd miss out as a result. But the... it makes much more sense from that perspective, saying this is the soldier of what happened and what happens. So tonally, as I think the first book's really harsh. I don't know where I would put it in the genre space. There's huge bits of it now, as I say, reading with a Trump view is very, oh God, he's actually saying that. Even the stuff where they say, well, we're going to go down to Brazil to have the war with Brazil. Yeah. When they've changed presidents, you kind of go, well, yeah, actually, we're not far away from that ourselves if somebody so decided to do so.
Yeah, it's a remnant of Mexico with America, isn't it? Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. But even,
It's,
So anyway, so that's...
A couple of the sort of tonal points I wanted to bring up with you are some of it's narrated and some of it isn't. And I'm a big fan of the first-person narration thing. But some of it isn't. It drops it. During action and during other moments. And I think that's possibly why I like her so much, is you hear her talk, but it's not a constant, which is interesting from a storytelling point of view. I suppose when you're spending 17 years on a comic, you choose to do what you enjoy, I suppose,
Some of it is thinks about the pacing of how you would read it. And there's a lot of, even in some of the early book, there's when she's in, all the battle scenes are quite quiet in terms of dialogue. They're very loud in terms of sound effects and stuff, and quite gruesome in terms of what's presented. But I think that helps you with the pace of reading it. In terms of you then go, I'm reading this page quicker than I'm, because there's less speech to slow me down. And this is a battle, so there's lots happening, and I can get through it really quickly because I can tell there's the excitement taking place.
I mean, you charge through this book when you read it. You do charge through it because of those. A lot of it is because of the action bits are so well done,
I must admit, when I said, "Oh, let's do Give Me Liberty," and you said, "Oh, let's do the slipcase," I was like, "Okay," and I probably took off the. I was like, "Yeah, oh,
I've had that with a few projects on this podcast, and I've got all excited and thought, Christ Almighty, yeah."
But you're right. I got through the first book really quick. Yeah. You do, and to be honest, that it was just availability of myself not to get through some of the rest of it quicker. After the first book, I think there's some really interesting pieces there as well, because they chuck in a couple of short stories that appeared either in Dark Horse Presents or actually came with the toy line, and a couple of those I really liked, where she meets the other soldier from the other side, and none of their equipment works.
I was going to talk about that in a minute. That's my favourite story. I don't know.
It's absolutely brilliant. Logistics, I think it's called, isn't it? No, State of the Art.
It starts as a mecha battle, just so people know. It starts as a mecha battle. She's fighting her opposite number, who's a dark-haired white female, as opposed to a blonde-haired black female. Who's from, and she's wearing the Southern States badge, and she's obviously from PAX. And they eventually end up stripping down to just guns. The first set of guns they fire at each other don't work. The second set of guns they fire at each other don't work. And they just laugh. And they have, and then they sit down and eat a meal. And she says, "We share rations, we swap stories, we don't talk politics." And I thought, it's the equivalent of the football match in No Man's Land, isn't it? It's the equivalent of that. Mm. So well done. And tonally, he was doing long-form storytelling, he was doing short-form storytelling, he was doing some little funny stories as well. It's a strange one, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, and it's another one of these bits where suddenly there's this dot of humour in the book that just really surprised you in terms of the mix. I think it's really nice as well that they actually put in the page with the black and whites there to show it was originally presented. That and one of the other ones later on for the Stranded in Space, I think some of the black and whites really show off, you know, how clean Gibbon's lines are, and just how tight a piece he's putting out.
And in a way, I remember thinking at the time, oh, he's doing more Martha Washington. He could be doing the Avengers or something, you know, because he spent a lot of time on this.
Mm.
I mean, there's some pages there you think are like weeks of work. You know, it's almost Darrow level of detail in some of these pages, aren't there? You know, especially some of the spaceships and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But then again, with the spaceship stuff, that's where I kind of go, there's, because of things like 2000 AD and a lot of the background, a lot of the UK artists, I think, when they end up in America, are given a lot of the machinery-type stories to draw.
Yeah.
Because they've gone through the training.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Because there was one of the other things, the spaceships. When looking at through this, the one of the books that brought to mind that again I've not read for a long, long time, was Ministry of Space.
Oh yes, the Warren Ellis book. Yeah.
Yeah, with Chris Weston, where again I think Chris Weston's style of drawing spaceships is very similar to what's in here.
And it all harks back a bit to Dan Dare, doesn't it? And all the golden age of British comics.
Yes,
it does. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's a bit of that where it kind of tends to
be a nice one. So we've started talking about the art. Was there any high points in the art that you liked or any low points you wanted to mention?
So the high points, there's loads, because it's Dave Gibbons drawing.
Yeah.
All sorts of stuff. You're right, some of the battle scenes are absolutely stunning in terms of how they're put together. The art, from the sort of second mini-series on, where they move to the colouring both digitally and they start putting in certain 3D rendering.
There's a few effects going, aren't there, that go in from there. There was a couple of, sort of landscapes that were given a sort of swirly effect, that clearly from a computer a couple of times, so I thought, I'd rather if that was just white.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, it didn't
fly. And that, yeah. So there's some disappointments with regard to that. And I think, you know what, again, I do wonder if there's something to be said there for printing on really shiny paper like this makes that even worse in terms of how it stands out. That make it difficult there. I'm trying to find this example just after Ghost to War. There's some of that where they really could have done with stuff in the background, just seeing what deals with.
Some of the in space stuff, when they go to like all white environments and they're wearing white suits and stuff like that, I found that really striking. I have to say, I really enjoyed that on a nice clean page. You know.
Yes. So if you jump to page, I'm making you work here. 426.
Right. I've got it on the iPad, so it shouldn't take me long. 400 and what? Sorry.
26.
Okay. Yes.
So this is the attack of the flesh-eating monsters. Yeah, because why not? So that the bottom panel on page 426. So this was a reprint again from Dark Horse Presents number 100, where they'd had many. They'd done a few pages for Dark Horse, and they put it into a one-shot that contained one or two other, or the contained a crossover, yep. Big Guy and Rusty. But it also had this.
And these creatures from space continue into the next story, don't they? They're the ones who are in the crashing spaceship with her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took me a second to work that out. But yeah, because I thought, oh, this is just a joke, little one they threw in. But yeah. Mm. Yeah, sorry, man. No, I've got that in front of me.
So, but what? Yeah, so I'm going to say, so if you look at the last panel on 426, but if you then, then the next two pages are the artwork in black and white, which is how it went out in Dark Horse Presents, where the very last panel, which is where the Earth is drawn and space is drawn by Dave, but on 426, they've done it as an effect where it's clearly a picture.
Yeah, they have.
And I'm going to tell you, I prefer the black and white.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I get you.
You know, because the character's colouring and all that sort of stuff, I've got no issue at all with the digital stuff and that. It doesn't really overpower. But yeah, just some of the backgrounds where they've gone for that effect. Sometimes it works when they've done some of the trees and mountains and stuff, but there's one or two where you're just like, you can tell it was the very early
90s. Yeah, they were trying. I mean, he himself says he was just experimenting, trying it
out for the first time. So that I think was possibly the weakness. Because certainly by the time it moves on to the much later books, it's absolutely.
I have to say as well, as an a slight aside, I quite like her with the dreadlocks. That's my favourite look for her. Yeah. I mean, bearing in mind, this is a character we intimately know because we see her at every stage of her life, and we see her naked quite a lot. You know. I get you, man. Yeah, completely. I have to say, one of my favourite moments was the. Is it Captain Kurtz? Is that the name of the character? He's like a Captain.
The Kirby character.
Yeah, it's like a perverted Captain America almost. Yeah. You know, like a. And Captain America about to die, protecting the Liberty Bell, that character. Can't remember the name of him there. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, Captain Crunts.
Right, okay.
Down here.
Yeah, yeah.
So page 234 for those following along.
So I have to say, art-wise, a little bit too in my face on the iPad. I haven't looked at that one yet in the book, and I haven't gone back to my back issues and looked at that one yet. But I have to say, that's an amazing sequence of very iconic images that... I don't know, I just found it leaped out as a sudden little story right in the middle of it, but one that was just really evocative of the time. You know, when you got to think that you had martial law and all that, those sort of books out at the time, this was, he's really a hero. I mean, she says, "You're the only hero I ever had," which is strange for her. It was a surprise for me to hear her say that. And he actually did kind of turn out to be a hero, didn't he? You know?
Yeah. And she held his honor true by not taking his blood back to the
she crashes it,
to the scientist.
He used super soldier serum and they had run out, so they needed his blood. And she's there. That's her job to get it. Mm. And she takes it off him. He sacrifices himself to save her, and she thinks no one else should have this. And she gets rid of it. Mm. Interesting.
Again, with the harking back to your point about the. Intellectual knowledge that she has, she actually doesn't know what the Liberty Bell is.
That's right, yeah.
Which is another sort of interesting one there. And again, in my notes here, I've written down to remind myself, at this point, she's still only 19 in the story, and we're on, you're on page 250 of the book, and she's only got to 19 years old.
Yeah, it's incredible. It really is good. So any other sort of moments that stuck out to you?
I think there's some interesting ones towards the end in the last storyline where, A, you're like going there, Dave's just taking the mic now by drawing a, he's a big dark grey man naked, where you're like going, okay, could this be? And it's the fact that he gets, or the alien at that point takes on the memories and the brain of the science officer, and therefore who she's constantly called Doc, and he gets pissed off at. So there's that panel where essentially you have a big, and it actually got lightning, and so he's a light blue at that point, a big light blue naked man standing there, and he goes, "Doc, indeed."
Yeah.
To say, he goes, "Stop," and you suddenly go, all right, the whole gag for the Doc thing was just a payoff.
Exactly. calling him down. Yeah, I know what you mean.
But there's a scene there as well where just a few pages before that, where he's killed all the alien, kills all the Venus people that are holding Wissenstein, and she sees that everybody's dying around her again, and everyone else is shocked, and the alien looks at her and she just turns and goes, "Give me a minute, I'll be right with you." And just the whole point, that the way that he sort of poses that, she then goes over and kicks him in the nuts, which is just, I thought that is a sort of sequence of just going, it's so mad here, but I'm just going to stop you for a second because I want to kick this guy in the nuts.
It's a go-to move. Go-to move. Yeah, I like the fact she did that a lot.
Yeah.
I have to say, I really like the, from my point of view, I really like the mutant punk group. There was like a, there's a punk band called Severe Tire Damage. Now, how much were they fucking ragging on the Cursed Earth at that point? You know what I mean? It's like a Dread storyline, isn't it? Yeah.
100%. It's the fact that she leaves her communicator with them as well by accident. And that's what they home to drop the bomb on.
The communicator is like, it's like Siri asking, oh, can I do something for you? It's like that, isn't it? You know, all the time.
Chuck.
That's right. And it's almost like, I want to be your friend. My name's Chuck. It's almost like that constantly on this, on her wrist. And she's clearly gone, oh, F that. Yeah. And she's put it on the wrist of this mutant, who actually she kind of gets on quite well with. They end up being mates almost, don't they, at one point? Yeah. One of my other favourite bits, well, it's full of stuff. There's little throwaway scenes that I just love. There's Sex Scandal Rocks the Vatican. I mean, that's just thrown in. Just like frankly, that I was just going to throw it in. So I love that. I love the Apaches. I thought they were really cool as a paramilitary group, and there's that bit where they were attacking. But as he does with a lot of stuff, he creates these whole tribes and races of people, and then he just destroys them. Yeah, so they appear, and I think, right on, there we go. She's going to side with them. She's, you know, we're going to get like a Lawrence of Arabia, you know, a Paul Atreides moment where she takes them on and she's part of them, you know. But they kill them all suddenly. Yeah. And then the other one I liked, which was the callback to the Shakespearean thing, which I mentioned earlier, was when they decide to stab the president to death. And it is the Night of the Long Knives, isn't it? They all have a... Mm. They all look like butter knives or something, but they all stab him and kill him.
It's the security guard through that sequence, in that the whole thing about the secret service man that's got the video on the president throughout, and every time he's like, oh, he's broken his bottle of whiskey.
Oh, so good.
Can you order up a bottle of whiskey? And then it's the, oh, he's killed somebody. Can you take the body out? And then it's like, the president's been assassinated. Yeah. Oh, I better leave now then. Yeah. And it's just that whole sequence of, again, it's those comedy hits that he just throws in of the security guard just watching it happen.
Really dark. I remember one of the nukes suffers from premature detonation. And you're like, seriously? Come on, Frank. What is that about? I so enjoyed it. The last... Go on, sorry.
The other thing I do think, it doesn't really come with the book here, but... When they do some of the cover galleries, the covers for these, for all of the series, were brilliant. And I say so much white on those covers.
Get that in a bag and a board straight away. That's the thing. That's the cunning. It's almost like a cunning ploy by Dark Horse to get you to buy two copies to me.
Well, no, because it wasn't that shiny paper, it held again. But you know, it's a very, but there was the common style throughout as well of the two, you know, Miller and Gibbons names at the top, then like a big red splash of what the story title is, then a bit in the middle, and then an image on the bottom of the page. I think all of those were absolutely really, you know, really good. And as I say, the cover set for Goes to War as well, where again it's some big bold images, but on a pure white background, just really, really stood up on the shelves back in the day, and they deserve a thing in their own right.
They're very iconic, aren't they? I think the thing is, as well, as often strikes me about this series is you occasionally get someone who is the dominant creator in a book. It might be the artist or it might be the writer, but these two are fucking both firing. You know, you've got everything from Frank. You've got all the ideas, all the scatterbombed craziness of it, which is just so amazing to read. But Dave retains, to me, a little bit of he holds that and he develops it, but he uses a comic sensibility that is slightly more traditional. You know, he doesn't, there's no like full-on mental full bleeds or fold-out pages, or, you know, there's none of this going on. He holds those titles and he holds those panels, and I just written, he knows the page turn. There's no, as much as I admire people like Sienkiewicz, there's not that going on with it, but it remains strange, you know.
Well, I think Gibbons is the exact opposite end from Zinkovich in that he's got a level of realism, photorealism, without going into the Alex Ross level of going, why not actually just take a photo and put it in? You know, what you're not adding anything here. You know, so he, again, it's the cleanness of the line, which I think when you've got that really clean image of something that is absolutely batshit crazy, like some of the battle scenes, or the big robot walking through the jungle shooting people, where you're like going, this is very clean and very specific as to what, you know, I can tell exactly what everything is here.
That could have been a page out of Robust on occasion, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
which I really like.
And that, where you've got that whole thing going, I shouldn't understand what's going on here, but because the image is so clear, I understand exactly what's going on here. So what am I not comprehending? Yeah, and you're struggling with yourself going, how do I not comprehend this? While had it been somebody more, even if it'd been Miller himself, where he's Miller's got a much more evocative image style of putting, I must admit, it's one of the things that really surprised me in terms of this whole book. There's only really like two images of Martha actually drawn by Miller.
Yes, that's true. There isn't there, and they're in the extras,
which is really quite surprising. But, you know, I don't think Mignola could do this either in terms of the whole book, because, again, you would, the style of the art would just wouldn't, you know, you'd lose something to it, and you'd be like going, you've got crazy on crazy there. It doesn't quite work. So I think there's something to be said for that, and just that's why, because this could have been an absolute car crash of saying, take the one half of Dark Knight, take one half of Watchmen, what could possibly go wrong? You know, how often have we said, put two great people together, and he's like, the sum of the parts does not add up there.
There's people thinking, oh, that's not going to work, you know, and it was never, I mean, I don't know if it was a huge seller. I'm not sure. Certainly towards the end, it wasn't like, it wasn't image level, was it, you know?
Well, no, it certainly wasn't.
Something of an evergreen, but not a big evergreen. It's not one that you often see in the best graphic novels of, you know.
It never, and again, part of that, though, is that, of their other works, obviously you've got Watchmen, you've got Dark Knight throughout there, even 300 and all of the Sin City books, because they've got other things that come with them,
That's
the movies or, you know, other related things, that keeps them alive in terms of people keep continuously coming back to them. You'd have to be told about this to go find it. And that's where I think it falls down in terms of not having that exposure, and that it needs something to elevate it back up, to say to people, you know what, this is out there. It's actually really good and deserves a lot more airtime than it currently gets.
You know, in the world of now of diverse casting, thankfully, you know, I think this would make a great TV series. They'd have to spend a few quid on it,
Well, the first couple of series, I don't think you would need to spend.
There are moments, but
because most of that's Earthbound. Well, you know, some of the battle scenes, for example, are probably, you know,
armies,
depending on how you want to film them.
They're Vietnam level, you know. Yeah.
I was going to say, is it any more than sort of the big battle scenes that you've seen in The Walking Dead?
Yeah.
I mean, I've not watched that for a few series, but you know, in terms of. You know, it's and because a lot of the fighting, you want it to be essentially hand to hand type thing. I think the first series of that is, once they start going to space, but even a lot of the space stuff nowadays, look at things like
Expanse or something like that. It can be done on a TV budget, can't it, these days? It didn't need to be,
Orville, even. You know, it's that sort of stuff where it's not an awful lot more than that. So I think this could easily have been a TV series, and people could have jumped in and out of it as they wanted to for that.
Yeah.
But
just before we sum it up, I'm going to ask you for a mark out of 10 in a second. But one thing that just occurs to me that I always like to mention is the, and it's something that Pat Mills always mentions, is this is. Unusual for the time, because it's certainly in English comics, it's a working class hero. You know, it's not James Bond, it's not Dan Dare. She is the epitome of the blue collar, you know, lower class, you know, underclass in America, fighting her way up to become probably the most preeminent soldier in PAX towards the end. You know, she's this famous warrior. She's the only thing I was trying to think what it compared to. I was trying to sort of think who she compares to. And the only one I can think of is fucking Sharp. You know the way Sharp is like, he's a sort of like rapscallion drinker fighter, and he saves, is it Nelson he saves, and he makes him an officer or something. And he fights his way up, and he, you know, eventually Sharp's responsible for the Battle of Waterloo or something, you know. And it's sort of it's the equivalent of that. She's this working on instinct kind of person.
She's your, she's also your James T. Kirk. In the, again, it's that dragged into it without necessarily wanting to be, and then
completely,
you know, which, you know, so I think there's scenes with that where you could go, yeah, didn't want to be there, but is there, but now's there. Although he's actually in, because the, a lot of it as well, it's not like she's got the design that she wants to be the, you know, the ultimate soldier, or the, you know, the, you know, the whole thing. She falls into a lot of the positions just by chance, and the will to live, rather than it being her desire to actually, you know, get on in the world. So there's a lot of that that,
I mean,
that
no
just happens.
Title for it than The Life and Times of Martha Washington, is there? You know, and I know we haven't mentioned this, but Martha Washington is actually the name of the first president of the United States' wife. Yeah, in a complete about turn. You know, you can look at the kahunas on Miller for calling her that. You know, amazing.
Well, yeah.
Cool. So what? So you have to give it out of 10. So I always like to have a little mark out of 10. I know it's worthless and it means nothing, but I'll tell you the other thing I meant to say to you. Did you go to UCAC in 93? This was there was a Martha Washington cover of UCAC from 93 for the program, which I always remember. Yeah, I think it might have been the last UCAC, pretty much, or maybe two before the end. But yeah, so out of 10, what would you give it?
No. So I would give Give Me Liberty. I would give it a straight 10 out of 10. The Life and Times of Martha Washington in the 21st Century as a whole, I'd give it an 8 out of 10.
I think I'm in agreement with you, man. I think that's a good shout. I think it's weakened a little bit by a couple of the little shorter stories and stuff. And I agree completely. But certainly the first series blew me away. You know, it's what was I when it came out? It was 22, 23 or something like that. And I was all over Swamp Thing and, you know, all these sort of deep books. And this came along and, science fiction, but done right. Yeah, definitely. Cool. We're going to talk about your comics in a second, Al, if you don't mind. But before then, I've got an advert. Bored?
Okay.
Been staring at those four walls for too long? Then why not try something that makes you think mice are crawling out the end of your knob? Or that Jaden, who works at your local Londis, is actually a lizard with only one single eye? Why not try LSD? It's a trip. Do not use whilst driving. May cause mental illness, flashbacks, blindness, impotency and depression. There you go. Thank you for that. Cool. Nice one. So that is, so we've managed to go all the way through 521 pages of comic. Well done, Al. You're my hero. Very enjoyable though. Absolutely loved it, man. And a really good experience in these locked in times. But what I wanted to move on to now is just a little bit of a talk about your books. So The Penguin, Rock and Roll Still Onwards. Is that right?
It does. I must admit, I'm not particularly far ahead at the moment in terms of drawing new ones, but there are still a couple of new ones every week that are going out, and then some from the files. So yeah, no, it goes out as a daily strip online. Anyone that wants a little humour in their life on any given day, then just find us anywhere on social media by searching for @Penguin. And it's a 3-panel strip normally, featuring funny little stories about funny little penguins.
So for those that don't know, it's mostly a 3-panel strip, although it does play about with the format on occasion, and sometimes it's a bigger strip. And it's kind of, I'm going to affectionately refer to it as dad jokes. I hope you don't mind, Al, but it brings a little smile. And I think some very very unoriginal reviewer once called it as the best book to have in your toilet. Which I very much. I have always, whenever I get a new one off you, I stick it in the downstairs loo just to have a read of a couple of comics as I'm doing my morning business, which is a very pleasant way to pass the time.
It's 100 pages, so that gets you through 100 visits. So therefore...
I'm very regular, to be fair.
Well, last time you ordered one up, I made sure you got something to stay comfortable with
as
well.
I went back to the last Kickstarter and you sent me a piece of toilet roll, which did make me fucking laugh. I was looking at it thinking, what's he putting it? Oh, right, I get you. Yeah, very good. And were you working on the Elspeth? Because I know occasionally you do some other books, don't you? Do you, I know I watched one of your readings online the other day. I have to say,
or my bedtime stories, as Bob called it the other day. There. So the real answer to that is no. I'm not working on any other specific books as such. I play around with a little bit of art and crafts every now and again. So I'm involved in
challenges. I think you've done a couple, haven't you? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I painted. Next week's, I did a little bit of that this afternoon for that. But yeah, no, the rhyming couplet books that I did about 4 years back, you know, 5 years back. Yeah, I decided to animate some of them while, you know, you're sitting in the house pretending to work from home. And I thought, well, let's play around with some of this. And that's why I did the recordings for those.
Which is the first place we met, isn't it? I think for a couple of reasons. Which I think is John Freeman gave it to me to review.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. You read Threadbare and I made you cry.
About a bear. Oh, I'm such a softie.
So yeah, that this is there. So no, I dip in and out of other things and supply bits of art for silly things like the ACP 250 anniversary
thank you so
comic.
Much for that. That was a good one. Yeah, we
no,
we
no,
absolutely
to say it was.
So you did a picture of me and Dan trying to talk Vince off the ledge after he hadn't pressed record. Yeah, we very much enjoyed that book. Yeah.
When Aaron was organising that, he said, pick an episode, and I was like, well, be wrong to pick my own, because that sounds a bit, you know. So what one? I said, all right, so I'll go for 134, I think it was, which took me a while to find is the number. But I was glad it was a number that I could easily make out of or incorporate into the picture in one way. But I thought there's no way I'll be the smallest number. Somebody will do something from near the beginning. But so I didn't think you would start the book with going, oh, get off the ledge, we will record
it. I think you texted me saying, I think I've given him PTSD again or something. I think,
Because I thought, I know you had problems, or Vince had problems when he first when I had the issue with the recording.
For those who don't know, me and Vince recorded, and Dan recorded a whole episode, and then he realised he hadn't recorded for whatever reason, technical reason. And I talked him down, and we did a quick 50-minute one. And he's like, oh no, what have I done? I said, don't, we're just going to have to repeat ourselves. Come on. And we did have a laugh in the end, but yeah. Dan, I messaged Dan, and Dan went, good stuff, man. So you're a regular at conventions. I know we can't really presuppose of any that we're appearing at, but I'm hoping, I'd love Thought Bubble to go ahead. Have you got a table there, or?
I was not successful in the selection this year. No, but I've got my hotel booked. I said I would be there on one side of the table or the other. If it goes ahead.
Yeah. Last year you were next to the Awesome Pod. You were next to Vince, weren't you? I was a bit further down at the No Bread table,
and wound him up no end throughout it. He was selling stuff from the table
stuff.
That was all
well,
sorts of weird and dodgy stuff.
Michael McKenzie, but yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but no, last year Thought Bubble was one of my most successful ever, so quite really disappointed not to get in this time round. But I think it's good actually to shuffle around. I think Thought Bubble needs to move to possibly the TCAF approach, the Toronto.
Have you done Toronto? I've never done Toronto.
Version where they. Oh, I highly recommend it as a show. It's basically the LCAF.
The guy who organised it came for. We went for a drink with him after LCAF. Super nice guy. Yeah. He came down for that.
But the TCAF does this thing where they say, essentially, if you were in it year one, then you're not, or you go to the bottom of the pile for year two.
Right.
You know, so they try, you know, basically, and so like, we've got so many people, you can only really attend it every other year as an exhibitor. Yeah. That's what
I'd love to see, especially in a town like Harrogate, which is comparable to a city like San Diego, where there's not much. It's not like Leeds or New York, where there's loads of other stuff going on. But you could almost have the main venue, and then you could have a pub that would stick tables out, you know. And I know we're...
My thing there is that even last year, where I was already at the point of going, because it's been so successful, and look, everybody that's putting stuff in Thought Bubble deserves to be there. I've got no problem with that. My problem is that there is still only so many people to come and attend it. And, you know, if there's 100 tables there and I walk into the show with £100 in my back pocket, then I've got £100 in my back pocket. If there's 300 tables there, I'm still only going to walk into the show with £100 in my back pocket.
We know it's more than that.
That's our one, you know. So I think my problem with saying, oh, keep making it bigger and bigger, is that it becomes a law of diminishing returns at that point in terms of what people are actually able to get.
Yeah. To that, isn't it? You know?
Well, the other thing that I was talking about for last year's Thought Bubble is that because it was across the two halls, they actually needed an hour each day where they could have turned around and said, right, everyone who's in the top hall, you stay at your table, but everybody who's in the lower hall, who's an exhibitor, this is your hour to go to the top hall.
Yeah, I didn't get anywhere. I remember at one point on Sunday, my legs moved as if they were doing a walk, and that was the first time I'd actually walked away from my table. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I got nowhere. I was lucky because I had a couple of mates down, and I was able to say, "Oh, I saw this on the way in today. Find out how much it is, and or pick me one up and stuff." And so I think there's the opportunity there to say, "Well, you don't want to do even if it was Friday night, it's exhibitors only."
LCAF, we have. Have you been to LCAF? I can't remember. On the Friday night, we have is it the Friday or the Saturday? I can't remember now off the top of my head. But we basically have a little bit of a party, and it's more sort of because we have our own beer brewed and stuff. And it allows people to have a wander around who've got tables or who are guests. Because I didn't get a chance to shop otherwise. You know?
Yeah, and I'd say, I think TV needs something of that ilk to play around with as well. And thereafter, as I say, I think it's just that whole... the interesting one this year will be if they turn around and say, you can't have an event, or you can have Thought Bubble, but events with more than 400 people at them are still barred.
Time, isn't it? Yeah.
You're going to go, how many exhibitors are there? Because there's about 400. So suddenly you've gone, we've got a gathering of 400 people, but it's all the exhibitors.
Well... I don't know. I mean, I hope it does happen this year. I don't know whether it will. I'm concerned that it won't. I'll put it that way. I know. Tomorrow is SparkCon, so we've started these sort of digital.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this a number of hours after it's released, you can go over and go to SparkCon, look for it on Twitter. But I think and certainly LCAF's moving into the digital space this year because we can't. It's too near because we run a summer event. So we can't do it. So we're going to do it as a digital, and we're looking at how to do that. And we're sending out some questionnaires about how we're going to run that and what the best way is and what's best for people. But it's a strange space, man. I mean, New York tickets should have come out by now and they haven't done.
And I'd penciled in potentially because I was thinking of doing the US con this year because of, Mrs. H was meant to be away with friends at one point in the year, which meant I had spare holidays. So I was thinking, I could either jump to New York and follow Sarah Harris's plan from last year and she went over her own.
You can leave your bag behind and over our table and go.
Well, the other option,
the original art.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of going back to the Baltimore Con. It's
really
cool.
I know you're an original art fan and Baltimore's famous for the original art scene. Is there anything that you've picked up recently that you've got? Because you're a commission man. Do you buy original pages as well?
I do buy, or I used to buy a lot of original pages. I think it's one of the things that there's less of them at cons now. Maybe it's just partially because I don't get out to see that. But in terms of a lot of the guests, it used to be that if you go to Bristol or whatever, people would sit with a pile of pages in front of them. And you just don't see as much of that now. And it could be that there's just fewer people or more people working digitally, so therefore there's less there.
Maybe
that sort of stuff. I don't know.
The age of the print.
Yeah, thing is, I would. And you're right in terms of the artist has to carry it all the way there and carry it all the way back again if they don't sell it. And if you can sell 10 £10 prints, is that better than selling one page for £100?
And the problem is, the market is really original pages. I bought a couple recently. And you get them shipped over, and then suddenly you're getting a bill for £33 for import duty, and you're like, I got a page for £160, and I was sort of being a bit cheeky in the first place in relation to how much I normally spend on a page, and then I've got to pay another, £30-40 quid on top of it. It's a funny situation.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, as well, and again, it was that last Baltimore con where I had the best piece of that, was, you know, if you're at the dealer's table, you can turn around and go, right, I'm buying three pages. Yeah. What's the deal?
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Yeah. And could actually end up speaking directly with is Anthony Snyder, who operates one of the big tables of all these things. And it was that whole thing about I had a couple of Frank Robbins strips in front of me from Johnny Hazard. And I'm like, he's like, so what's the deal? And I'm like, well, I can't decide between them. And I think they're supposed to be like $70 each. You know, so you're still thinking, it's nothing. But, you know, in the scheme of going, I've already dropped $1,000 today on different bits of art. You know, I need to. So it's like, I can't pick between the two. And he went, well, what about both of them for 100?
Oh, my God.
And you're like,
oh, my God. What's your address again?
So, and it is that.
I did the same.
That's not the expensive stuff. The expensive, the one that I've got on the wall next to me up here, the one's the one that you really want, because I've got the first appearance of Harley Quinn in continuity and costume.
Wow. Okay.
On the wall next to me, by Yves Guichet. That's the one that I always go. It's probably worth a bit of money now.
Oh, nice work, sir. Yeah, leave it till everyone forgets the Birds of Prey movie, and it'd be worth a few quid more.
I'm sure
you're doing
it
right.
Still got her.
Yeah, definitely. I did the same with Burns Dealer, actually. I had a Burns Dealer and got a burn page last time I was in New York, which they thought was very funny on the No Brad table, because I said, right, I'm going to leave this here. I need to go to the loo. And I came back and said, where's that page gone? Oh, we don't know where it's gone. Oh, yeah, funny. Here we go.
It's been a while since I bought any actual original pages, but no, I'm still chipping away with the old commission here and there.
Any recent ones? What you got on the bubble? Or?
So one that's finished, but I don't think it's been posted to me yet because of obvious reasons, is by Simone Darmini, the Spider King book is what you might be known for. Which came out from IDW. He's actually based in Edinburgh. Okay. Who knew? It was one of those ones where something came up and I was like, yeah, you're based in Edinburgh, because he's Italian, but just happens to be living in Edinburgh. So I was like, well, fine. But so that'll be another shadow piece.
So you're a big shadow collector.
That goes into the collection.
Your original piece, commissioning piece collection, isn't it?
Yeah, which again dates back to the early 90s and getting into the Shadow Strikes from DC at that point in time. Barretto was the we'll not talk about the writer. For other reasons. Having met Mike Kaluta, which is still the top point for that, there's a lot of high points in that. And this is, again, it's the way the convention scene has changed over the years. Because if you go back to those Bristols, where I would go into those Bristols with, you know, a nice little sketchbook, and you'd come away with anything. Or, you know, I remember one year we did Ridiculously Stupid and got something like 30 sketches, right? And that's partly because you would go up and down the 2000 AD table or whatever, and you'd have all the art droids there doing their thing. But everyone would do a nice little quick sketch. Bang, bang, and everyone will be happy. You can't get that at all at a convention. You go to a convention now and you say, oh, I'd like something. You're like, could you draw me something? So, it's $300 and it's going to take me 4 hours. And you're like, I don't want to spend $300 in 4 hours. I just want you to do me a nice, spend a minute on it and I'll be happy.
Have you tried one of those jam pieces? I haven't done one yet. I'm sort of tempted to, where you get all the characters from a particular, the Guardians of the Galaxy or something like that. And some of them are quicker sketches than others. Yeah, I might give that a go one day. Yeah. I don't know if I want all the different artists on one page sometimes. I kind of like something a little cleaner, almost, but yeah, you're right. And the worst thing is that is some. I always pick and choose my artists carefully these days, because if they've got like, 20 quid for a head sketch, I go, I collect Master of Kung Fu sketches, and I go and then I'll get one done. And then I think, how quick are they going to be? And then you go back and you say, how are you getting on? And you think, I want to go home. I want to get the train home. There's a couple of naming no names. There's a couple of artists who've owed me pieces. Like every year I email them to say, how are you getting on? And they never reply, but I just do it out of fucking sheer bloody mindedness. You know, how are you getting on with it? Which I've already paid you for, obviously.
I had a couple that took several years. There was one I thought I'd basically given up on, and then suddenly it sparked back into life again. But yeah.
So anybody white, you got any white whales? You got any people you'd love to get one from and haven't found yet, or?
I thought I was Zinkovich. So Zinkovich for me would be the obviously the one that's missing from that sort of canon of people who did the Shadow. But I've never managed to think.
Yeah.
I have met him, but he wasn't sketching at that point in time. Yeah. That's just the way it goes.
I got his sheet from where he was doing like rough little getting his pen ready and doing little diagrams, and I just asked him for it, and he gave it to me in New York once, which I was quite pleased about. So that's all I've got. But you need to meet Richard after it as well. I think, you know, you hear about £3,000, £6,000 from him. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's
or dollars rather. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that's not what, you know, as I say, I would quite be more than happy to turn around and go, here's
just
a biro.
Outline, yeah.
Going to spend 2 minutes on it. And, you know,
because
I know that you can do that and you can produce something that would make me happy. And I would be more than, you know, because it's, I mean, as I say, it's that Dave Gibbons approach again of going, right, I've got a queue of 20 people in front of me. Let's say 3/4 of them want a Rorschach. Another couple of them are going to want a Rogue Trooper. Here you go. Bang, bang, bang. By the way, most of them are going to look pretty identical. I have seen him draw Rorschach as well while still looking the person in the eye, not actually looking at the page, which is quite clever.
And in his later years, he had a book out about his comics, and I watched him do the outline of the Flash, like pretty much whilst talking to someone, and at the same time cupping his ear because he couldn't really hear what they were saying.
You see, that's the other reason I want to go back to a con in the States, is to, you know, there are still a handful of the Silver Age.
I've got one in front of me from Joe Sinner.
The Golden Age card, you know.
The loveliest talk I've ever had with the creator. You know, Joe Kubert when he was there. You know, there's all these people, you know, you'll still see Ron Wilson, for example, at a convention, someone like that, you know. Just gold that we don't see over here enough. Yeah.
I remember the last time we met Jim Colan, which was not long before he died, and you could tell he had a huge cataract in one eye type thing. And you were like, going, so that's why that side of the page is always a bit, you know, not quite as tight as the other side of the page.
Yeah, I love it. I was looking at some of his, I'm on some Facebook group, and they were posting some old cat pages of his today, and I'm like, oh, God, how does he draw like that? It's incredible. How does the mind work? Yeah. Good-o. Mate, thanks for that. We've overrun significantly, but that was brilliant.
No worries.
That's okay. 500-odd page book, so that's completely allowed.
Exactly.
Hopefully you got something out of
good
that.
Stuff.
You can find me, good man.
You
can find me normally over at neverunanything.blogspot.com. Buy my comics at neverunanything.bigcartel.com. Find me on Twitter at Ezo, yes, E-Z-O-H-Y-Z. If you want to listen to a proper podcast, head over to awesomecomics.podbean.com or the podcast catcher of your choice. Where can they find you, Mr. H?
So if you go onto any form of social media and just search for Penned Gwyn, that's PennedGuin, you'll find me. Or if you want me as an individual on Twitter, I'm Shadow1972.
And that, as they say, is history.